This is episode 64 of the Fifth Estate podcast. Noah Rothman, the trials and tribulations of tax reform.
Folks, your luggage shouldn't cost more than your plane ticket. Away Travel's luggage is designed with the highest quality materials, and they're still under $300. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/fifth and use promo code fifth during checkout.
All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
Jay, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm a little under the weather, but I'm recovering.
Under the weather.
Yeah. Can you believe that? My first Texas cold.
You're down with a sickness.
Down with the sickness. I can't
I'm sorry
sing
to
like
hear
that guy,
Jay.
Though. Yeah.
But would it make you feel any better? Would it help aid your recovery if perhaps our listeners were to, I don't know, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating?
Well, that always helps. I mean, that's always, you know, a good thing. When people go to iTunes and they sit there and they give us a 5-star rating and they tell us how wonderful we are, it's always good. It always lifts my spirits, even when I'm not sick.
Indeed, sir. Yes, indeed. So, you know, folks, if you're out there and you like the show, you like what we're doing, you know, give us that 5-star review and tell folks about it. Tell other people about what we've got going on here.
Yeah, so Neil, you know, it's funny, they're actually talking about like policy in you know, in the news and in Congress and even in the White House. Can you believe that?
Not really, Jay. I can't believe it at all.
But they are. They're talking about tax reform, and they're not, hopefully, really? I mean, hopefully they're talking about like real tax reform, not, you know, hey, we're going to cut the corporate rate and that's going to be it, or we're going to eliminate the, you know, the estate tax and that's it, but, you know, actual reform.
Comprehensive tax reform.
It would be nice. It's been 30 years since that's
happened. About time. I'd say we're due.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, 30 years ago when the Tax Reform Act came out, I think it cut rates. There were like two different rates. It was like 15% and 28%. Now we have seven different brackets.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even understand that stuff, Jay. I mean, I've not been alive long enough to see the last time we had tax reform. But, you know, the question, of course, is what kind of chances does this have of actually going anywhere?
Yeah, always. That's always the question.
And so to help explore this topic, we decided to bring in someone who is a bit more knowledgeable on the politics and policy than we are. And that is Noah Rothman, the associate editor at Commentary Magazine. Hi there, Noah.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. So, Noah, you've been on the show before, but I did want to just give a quick plug for your delightful magazine and also for your podcast, which I am a regular listener to. Very, very enjoyable, sir.
Thanks, guys. And you reminded me that we haven't been doing that whole give us a 5-star rating on iTunes thing, which is very important. Totally just forgot about that. So I'm going to remind tomorrow.
You should do it. If the begging can break through the crushing morosity, then I think, you know.
And it works. It does work.
It does work. Yeah, let John know. Begging works.
But like you guys said, you know, I don't know anybody who's in our generation who can call themselves a tax policy expert or a tax politics expert. We're digging up some well-trodden ground here, but every time it's been trodden, it's failed in our experience. So the urgency is different. The urgency feels different. But the outcome, I am resigned to not being all that different.
Interesting. Well, I wanted to start off by you know, just saying, you know, we've got people like Ted Cruz, who are saying that tax reform is a fundamental promise that Washington is grappling with. And given the senator's recent troubles on Twitter, I don't know if I would have gone with the phrase grappling, but it's a serious question. Are the people in Washington, are Congress, are the president, are they actually grappling with this issue? How serious is the effort this time?
Well, I was struck, flash back to November 8, 2016. And, you know, anybody who tells you that they saw Donald Trump winning this thing, who wasn't a full-blown, you know, MAGA head, red hat wearing super fan, I don't think they saw that coming. But the people who didn't see that coming and were Republicans were all of a sudden thrilled. And I was struck by one particular tweet from Alyssa Farah, who's the spokeswoman for the Freedom Caucus, who said on Twitter, in her elation, that, you know, we're getting calls now from people who are like, oh, my God, we can do tax code reform. Nobody thought about this. Nobody had this in the roster of things that they were going to do. Obamacare was great. But tax code reform is the absolute be-all, end-all of what we want to achieve. And, you know, in those heady moments, it seemed like a plausible notion. But as I've said on television before, Donald Trump's election is like the torment of Tantalus. He provides Republicans with this, you know, golden set of options now that they didn't know they had, and they're just within reach. But Trump himself is the obstacle before those options. He's either off in his own world creating new controversies, or he's subtly or overtly undermining Republican efforts, notably the effort to get healthcare reform done. Everybody thinks this was a Republican failure, and it was. But it was also an effort that was undermined by the fact that the president was out there saying that the original Republican deal in the House, the American Healthcare Act, was, quote, mean, quote, needed heart and more money. Whenever you didn't even have to say more money, because once you say more heart, every conservative knows what that means. And so now he's out there telling anybody who listens that he wants to raise rates on the rich. And he's not going to get a bill that raises rates on the rich. And nobody's even asking him, I think, if he's going to veto this thing that doesn't give him his priorities, because I don't think anybody thinks he would. It's just kind of something he says. And that's who says things that nobody believes, that nobody thinks he means, that everybody thinks he's just a rubber stamp. And to the extent that he exists, he is an obstacle to Republican priorities.
I agree. I agree with what you're saying, Noah, especially about Trump, you know, raising the political cost of doing, you know, I always say anodyne Republicans, the things, you know, a Republican Congress and a Republican president would face unfair attacks from Democrats and you know, media spin that was unfavorable to what they want to do. But that's surmountable in many ways. The problem with Trump is he introduces this, I think, instability, this X factor of you don't know quite what he's going to do. You know, is he going to cut a deal with Chuck Schumer? Is he going to say something that makes people think perhaps he's giving veiled support to supremacists, which makes the issue that much more politically costly for the people who have to actually enact the policy, namely Congress. You know, Trump is somewhat insulated from his issues here that he seems to have, but Congress might take the actual brunt of it.
Yeah, and the thing everybody keeps saying, you know, well, tax reform is going to be harder than healthcare reform. And in a way, it is, in a different way. There were millions and millions of stakeholders in the tax code, in the healthcare reform effort, and they were consumers of healthcare products. There are fewer, you know, important in the tax code debate, but they're more influential. And those are everybody who's gotten a carve out over the last 30 years, particularly on the corporate side. You know, what everybody wants to do in theory is flatten the thing, make fewer rates, and make them a lot more applicable across the board, get rid of all these carve outs and loopholes and what have you. Because in reality, you have a relatively high corporate tax rate in the United States, but most companies that would pay quite a bit of taxes on it don't. The effective tax rate is quite low. So what everybody wants to do is flatten the tax code. And once you get a flatter tax code, the gnashing of teeth and rending of garments from corporate America will be deafening, and it won't survive the first iteration. So that's when people say, it's going to be a process, they mean that first draft, second draft, the things that don't survive entry. That's what they're expecting. So the longer this goes, the farther we get along in the process and the closer toward an election year, the harder these votes become. And that's why I'm not so sanguine about the prospect of tax code reform. We need to get early and off the Band-Aid and take the pain early, and getting closer and closer to the point where I don't think that's plausible anymore.
Yeah, and I think what, and that's what makes, I think, Republicans nervous. And, you know, for, you know, you don't want to turn this into a Trump bashing session, but the reality is what you said was true. And during the campaign, one of the things that Donald Trump did, I've always go back to this video of him during a Republican debate. It was Mary Catherine Hamm asked him the question about, you know, negotiating deals. And he said, you know, with Congress, what you have to do is get everybody in a room and you have to make a deal, but you have to come out with the deal that you want, you know, the deal that you want, not what anybody else wants. And that's how you do it. You know, so he's the guy who has been promising that he can make the deals that other guys couldn't, that he could bring so-and-so on board and he can get this one on board. And yet, you know, when healthcare failed, it was, you know, he has that base of support that's going to turn around and blame Mitch McConnell and blame Paul Ryan. But, you know, like you said, when you can't sit there and expect things to work out well when you have a Rose Garden celebration for House passage of a bill that you later attack weeks later. So,
you would think. I mean, you laid it out there pretty soon.
And that's what I'm afraid of with the tax bill, is that because what's going to happen is what you said and what Neil said is right. No matter what happens, the moment this thing comes out is the moment, you know, the mainstream media will start talking about how it benefits the wealthy and how the rich are going to save more money. And, you know, people, you know, of course, they're going to compare it against a section of people that already don't pay hardly any income tax and say, oh, well, so-and-so who makes $40,000 a year is only going to see savings of $135 a year, while so-and-so who makes $440,000 is going to save, you know, $8,000 a year, you know. And it's like, well, of course, because they're paying more already, they're going to get larger savings in any kind of tax bill. And here's the other thing, you know, you have, there is the whole revenue neutral type of bill. Now, if and I think this goes back to, and somebody will have to correct me if I'm wrong when they're listening to the show, I think if they want a revenue neutral bill, then that is something that's going to have to garner 60 votes. But those tax cuts will also be permanent. Whereas if they go the other route, they could do it through reconciliation, but then those tax cuts are only good for X amount of years, and then they'd have to revisit them. It was similar to the Bush tax cuts, where they had to kind of go back and make them permanent once they were in. You know, I think it's easier to do that rather, I think that's the easier part. But, you know, the politics is still there, and you have to wonder, you know, are Republicans in Congress saying, we're going to draft this plan, and the president's going to sit there and praise it, but then what is he going to do after that, once the criticism starts?
He's going to abandon it, because, as you said, there's going to be horrible press.
Yes.
He doesn't sustain, you know, through horrible, horrible press. He's very sensitive to press coverage, and he likes getting good press, and you get really good press by working with Democrats. And so he's going to work with Democrats. I mean, that was the feedback loop that he received from this pivot, this heel turn towards Democrats over the debt limit, this temporary deal with Democrats over the debt limit, which he said he justified miraculously in his mind. He justified it by clearing the field for tax code reform. So apparently he loved the press that he got from being a quote unquote centrist, which was essentially taking the Democrats' first deal. And he's going to get a Republican bill that's going to be mean and hard-hearted and raise the burden on or lower the burden on corporations and the rich. And then he's going to attack it, because that's what he did.
Exactly what he did with the health care. And think, yeah, it was mean, and he didn't like it. He, you know, that's
so the notion that we're going to get a pro-growth tax code reform out of this guy strikes me as remarkably sanguine, I guess, for lack of a better word, sort of optimistic and unnecessarily so. So I've seen nobody reconcile with this. I've seen nobody even like talk about it. We're still sort of in this euphoria of, you know, maybe we haven't reached the point of diminishing returns yet. And I don't think we're going to get to the point of diminishing returns until Republicans lose a chamber. I don't know what it's going to take. And this is why I'm so down on the prospects of tax code reform moving forward, or any Republican big reform out of this administration. I just don't see it happening, because the guy can just be a rubber stamp. He can't do that. And the presidency won't allow that. So, I'm not in a very positive mood about moving forward. And we may be lucky. Maybe we'll get like you said, a 10-year tax cut of the budget reconciliation process. But that would be a humongous failure for this particular moment. This apex of Republican power, almost the Democrats almost had a nadir of. We're not going to see this again in our lifetimes. Unless, something else happens to Democrats, because they could totally blow it. They do stink. But the likelihood is that Democrats are going to make a comeback, because they usually do. Pendulum swings. And we're going to lose this moment. And we're going to lose the opportunity for conservative reforms. Well, and that's, Republicans deserve it, by the way, because they got into bed with somebody who's not a conservative.
Exactly.
No.
Yeah, I agree there, Noah. And I think what you're saying, it speaks to that urgency that you mentioned earlier. We've got this moment. They don't want to waste it. And they haven't really put forward anything, any major legislation yet. It's kind of mind-boggling. The only real benefit that the right has gotten from getting into bed with Trump is Neil Gorsuch. But a baboon could have nominated Neil Gorsuch. Any Republican would have nominated Neil Gorsuch.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily something that you can give Trump credit for. But the urgency really, raises the question for me, who needs this more? Who needs a win more? Does Trump need the win more, or does the GOP need the win more, the congressional GOP?
Congressional GOP needs this win more, much more, by a long shot. As you said earlier, Donald Trump has a built-in base of support. Perception is reality, and we perceive, for some bizarre reason, that Donald Trump's base of support, that 36% of whatever it is all he needs right now. And all anybody cares about. So I don't agree with that, but that is the perception and the prevailing wisdom. So if that's his built-in support, and they can find happiness in Democratic deals, quote-unquote, with Democrats, then they're not going anywhere. They will find a nugget to latch onto, whatever the president does. Republicans, on the other hand, have a lot of ground to cover and a lot of promises to make good on, which, by the way, they have been a very poor at organizing as a conference behind any sort of legislative agenda. They don't necessarily need the president to push forward an agenda, and they're locked into this antediluvian view of governing that says, we need the president to take the lead on just about everything, or we can't make it work. And there's some reality to that, but a lot of that is also perception and a marriage to an old way of doing things. Republicans could take the bull by the horns if they had not just leadership, and I don't think leadership deserves all the criticism that they're getting, but some of it is meritorious, but also somebody who'll put the screws to a few of these recalcitrant members of the conference, particularly in the House, who are hell-bent ensuring that the perfect becomes the enemy of the good. And they have been a problem during the Obama years, and now they're an obstacle to governance. And to an extent, that conference, that aspect of the conference, they are. But just about as, the Tuesday group has got its own issues, and your Susan Collins have their own issues. This is the problem with having a big sprawling coalition. When you're a governing party, you cross a lot of ideological boundaries, and it's hard to, herd those cats. But that was sort of the reason why we had Paul Ryan in place, in the place that he is operating in now, right? He was the only guy who could unite this conference. And they're operating without presidential leadership. So we do need somebody like Paul Ryan. You need to have somebody who operates as a presidential figure in the absence of the president. I don't see that happening. I don't see anybody willing to take that role. I don't see anybody willing to take the bullets associated with that role. And it'd be really nice if we had somebody like that. But like I said, the Republican president is a Republican president in name only. The literal rhino. And we have a real absence of leadership and a bunch of Republicans with their own agendas trying to do stuff without the national agenda in mind, with their own constituencies in mind, as the system was designed to do But in the presence of, in the case of something like a big reform, like tax code reform or Obamacare, it's an obstacle. It's not an advantage.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit more about this when we get back. We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
Hey there, folks. Neil Dewing here to tell you about our friends at Away Travel. Now, Away Travel's luggage is designed with the highest quality materials, but they can keep it under $300 because they cut out the middleman and sell it directly to you. All suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, which is unrivaled in strength and impact resistance, while also being very lightweight. You can choose from a variety of colors and four sizes: the carry-on, the bigger carry-on, the medium, or the large for extended stays. The interior, and this is what I'm very excited about as an overpacker, the interior features a patent-pending compression system. So if you just want to have that shirt just because you think you might need it, or an extra pair of pants, put them in there. Go for it. Everything about the Away Travel luggage is designed for the traveler's convenience and comfort. There's four 360-degree spinner wheels, guarantee a smooth ride, TSA-approved combination lock, a removable, washable laundry bag, okay? This is the real winner for me. Both sizes of the carry-on are able to charge all cell phones, tablets, e-readers, and anything else that's powered by a USB cord, okay? A single charge of the Away carry-on will charge your iPhone 5 times. No more Mad Max at the airport, guys, okay? It's a new dawn, all right? A new era. There's a lifetime warranty on these things, so if anything breaks, they'll fix it, they'll replace it for life, right? 100-day free trial. If you don't like it, return it, no questions asked. There's free shipping on any Away order within lower 48 states. And of course, all these carry-on sizes are compliant with the major U.S. airlines while maximizing the amount you can pack, okay? They've made it absurdly easy for you to make this decision. So for $20 off a suitcase right now, this is a special offer to our listeners, visit awaytravel.com/fifth and use promo code fifth during checkout. One more time, that's awaytravel.com/fifth and use promo code fifth at checkout for $20 off any suitcase.
Welcome back, folks. Fifth Estate here, Neil Dewing and Jay Caruso. We're talking with Noah Rothman of Commentary Magazine. And Noah, we were talking about the Republican caucus and how fractious it is, and how there seems to be just a lack of leadership. You're pessimistic about, you know, the prospects for tax reform generally, specifically about Republicans in the House working together, or in the Congress working together. You know, let's analyze a little bit about what's going on here. What are the real obstacles here for Republicans to come together and actually agree on the way forward?
Well, in terms of policy, you'll probably have to find somebody who's better on policy than I am in that case.
Let's talk personalities and politics, because I feel like that has a lot more to do with it than the actual policy. I feel like the differences in degree on policy are minute, but it's approach. It's personal politics. It's people, I think, personalities, difficult personalities, that sort of thing.
Well, you have, you know, the big ideological camps in the Republican Party are pretty sprawling. And like we said before the break, you know, that's sort of a function of having a big governing majority, is you have a lot of ideological camps all across a sprawling geography. You know, Democrats have the benefit of having the problem that Republicans had in 2009, which is a really small conference that's reduced to its minor enclaves, and ideological homogeneity. That makes everything pretty easy, as you've seen from everybody getting behind this single-payer ruse over the course of the last 24 hours or so. You know, that's the equivalent of their repeal and replace for now. It's a really easy, no-cost thing to say, and generally, there's a real progressive conference in there. But once Republicans, Democrats retake and majorities, are going to find out that it's harder to govern with a big, sprawling group of people with different ideas. But so,
do you think that part of the issue is that while Democrats certainly have their ideological battles, it seems that on the Republican side, if you disagree on immigration, for instance, that you are outside the fold and cannot, you know, any, you know, attempt to work with that sort of person would be viewed as a betrayal of conservative ideals. Whereas on the leftist side, on the Democratic side, there's a bit of that, but perhaps they fall into line a little bit more readily. Do you think that's a fair point to make, or do you think that's a distinction, or is that sort of overstated?
Well, I guess it depends. You know, ideological heresy is sort of applied selectively these days. Mm-hmm. I still see, you know, the Conservative Review putting out Red Hat cartoons being, you know, talking about how the rhinos are giving Democrats everything they want, as though we're still operating in that paradigm. Like, we really haven't had the opportunity to fully comprehend what happened last week when Donald Trump sat down with Democrats, heard the first offer, took it, got a bunch of great press, and now is talking about removing the debt ceiling with Chuck Schumer, and he's getting rid of the wall funding with DACA, and he's talking with Nancy Pelosi and coordinating his tweets. It's all though nobody really internalized that happening. We still want this comforting narrative, this comfort blanket from the Obama era, where you had Republican establishment rhinos and fighting conservatives who fight the hardest fight they ever fought. And that's just nonsense. You know, it's just absolute trash. And the fact that people are still married to that view is, to me, indicative of the bankruptcy of that view. It always was a particularly bankrupt point of view. But it's become a money-making venture for a lot of people. They can't let it go. So I'm dismissive of that, you know, stir up the rabble in the Twitterverse sort of situation. And I don't think that really, that doesn't matter for governing in an off year. We'll talk again in, you know, 12 months, see where we're at.
Yeah,
but today I don't think that's really the biggest hurdle. The biggest hurdle is in an off year is really generating good policy that's not going to come back to bite them. And you have two big camps. You have genuine ideological conservatives in the GOP. You have quote unquote moderates who are more willing to see Democratic priorities in the form of softer legislation, softer on the rates, for example. And then you have the sort of like the weirdos. I'm going to call them the weirdos because they're like the Rand Paul types, who are absolute ideologues who won't compromise on anything at all and amount virtually to Democratic votes because they are so rigid and inflexible that they have no interest. Real genuine policy they'd rather posture, and they end up functioning as opposition votes. And then you have the governing wing, and the governing wing is probably the smallest possible wing you can imagine. That's leadership, essentially. That amounts basically to leadership, who are beholden to the conference as much as they are their constituents. Herding all these guys into one direction is extremely impossible. You get the weirdos out of there, they're gone. But getting these disparate groups to agree on anything beyond we need to flatten the code, we need to lower the rates, is extremely difficult. And I'd love to see somebody put forward some kind of a view that amalgamizes the desire to see a flatter tax code with what Donald Trump wants to see, which is a much more progressive code. And that can be done, frankly. It probably should be done. But it's not something that's going to win enough Republican votes to pass in the House, much less the Senate. It may do better in the Senate, but it won't pass the House.
Yeah.
And you could see that if there was some leadership from the White House, I think. But you're not going to see any of that.
No. And the problem with that is that the whole idea of a flatter tax, you know, what the highest rate now is what? Is 41% or something? It's not even 39.6. I think it is over 40%. They added that extra bracket back in that deal that they did in 2012. So then the question is, you know, what are they going to do? I mean, that's where it comes in, because if you're going to go at a flatter rate, I mean, unless you have like three, you know, people are saying they want three rates. Okay, well, what are you going to have? 10, 15, and 40? You know, it's not going to work that way. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a whole bunch of people that are going to fall in between that area, where somebody's going to say, well, you know, somebody who's making $85,000 is going to pay, this 15% rate, but so is somebody who makes $200,000. They're not going to hit that 40% until they get over this other hump. So, you know, those people, those are rich people that are going to get big tax breaks.
Well, and again, I'm not an expert on the policy, but I would bet that somebody who is an expert on the policy would say that the individual marginal rates are not the stumbling block here. It's the corporate rates.
Well, it's the corporate
reducing
rates.
Reducing the corporate rates down from their current 25 to, they want 15, but anything under 20 or even 20 is going to be an absolute victory. And it's flattening the code. It's getting rid of all those carve-outs for individual firms who happen to be particularly influential. That is where the real stumbling block is, because that is where the revenue is. And that's where people have real vested interests.
Right. And there's the other problem. There are two taxes that Trump wants to get rid of, which is the estate tax and the alternative minimum tax. Now, Donald Trump's tax return that was leaked from 2005, that's going to become a focal point, because in that tax return, there was so much carried interest that he was able to take care of that he almost had zero tax liability except for the alternative minimum tax. So he paid $31 million in taxes on $150 million in income. And if they want to eliminate that, that's going to become a focal point. That's going to be another one of those things where it's going to focus on him, where they're going to talk about how much he would sit there and benefit from a particular tax. And then they're going to go into the inheritance tax, and they would talk about how much they would benefit, you know, how would Donald Trump's kids benefit from him if he passed, you know, that kind of thing. And that's where we get into the whole idea of, will Donald Trump then sit there and say, okay, well, we don't have to do those, you know, after the House has already like produced a bill that maybe has that in there, a reduction in the alternative minimum tax or a reduction in the estate tax. I swear that we keep coming back around to this, but that is going to be the ultimate question. When a bill finally does come out from the House, what is it going to have? And then how is the president going to react to it? Because he's not involved in the detailed discussions. And this is where I get so frustrated with people who sit there and they blame Congress constantly, but that ignores the history of presidents being involved in the details of what goes into a particular bill. They have legislative people that sit, you know, to sit there and say, well, this is what I want, and this is what I want, and let's see it get in there. This whole idea that President Trump is supposed to just sit back, kick his feet up, and wait for Congress to hand him something to sign is ridiculous. And that's the reason why I, like you, Noah, I'm very skeptical that anything is going to get done, because I think the moment this plan comes out from the House and it gets attacked, the president is going to turn on it and run for the hills and look once again to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to see what to do. And then you might get some kind of mealy mouth little kind of tax reform that then you have, like you said, the quote unquote, the weirdos aren't going to agree to it. And then it's all going to wind up going downhill. And next thing you know, it'll flop, kind of like the healthcare bill. We're just a ray of sunshine here.
Yeah, no, I don't have any. Part of the problem with the Trump era is that you can't strategize from day to day. You really can't project a week out and, you know, make sure that that's your plan and stick to it, because something's going to come down the pike and the president's going to react to it in a way that's unpredictable, which he finds to be beneficial to him personally, but isn't beneficial to anyone else. And that's going to upend the status quo, the equilibrium, the plan. Everything goes out the window. And remember, when Donald Trump struck his quote-unquote deal with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, that was the end of it. Within 48 hours, there was a bill on the president's desk. When the president says, this is the way it's going to be, that's it. Not because Congress doesn't have a spine, although that's part of it, but because he cuts off avenues for which legislation could be negotiated within the conference, among Democrats and Republicans. It stops the debate right there, because they know what the president wants, what the president's going to sign, and what he won't sign. And he usually gets what he wants when he says something like that. So that's why people want the president to keep his mouth shut. And if he could do that, if he could stop tweeting, stop talking, stop sharing his thoughts with the press, he'd probably have a much more successful presidency.
Well, so when do Republicans start to just say this, what you're saying, out loud? I mean, when do they just start to say, we need to be left alone to do our jobs, and we're going to send something to the president's desk, and we don't know what he's going to sign. We're just going to be honest with you, the American people. we are just as confused by this guy as you are, but we're going to do our best, and we're going to put a bill out there, and if it gets signed, at least you know we put a bill on his desk. If it doesn't get signed, well, at least you know we put a bill on his desk.
Well, I just...
Would that take too much of a spine from congressional Republicans, or are they truly right to be wary of this base of economic populists that seems to be supporting the president?
Yeah, I think they are right to be worried about the extent to which they're vulnerable at home, for if they anger a very mobilized but small base of Trump supporters, the kind of guys who would vote for a Steve Bannon-like candidate. Because as we've seen, that has some potency. You just look to the special election going on right now in Alabama for the United States Senate. You had a proxy campaign, essentially, between the conservative radio universe, which got behind I'm blocking on his name, Mo Brooks, Representative Mo Brooks. He was supported by Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, Laura Ingraham. He came in third place. He was out of the running. Then you had your Mitch McConnell-backed candidate, who is the acting senator, Luther Strange. I'm Mitch McConnell, and tepidly by the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Going to lose to a guy with a very checkered past. We're going to have a senator who is a controversy magnet. He's the Steve Bannon candidate. So that's going to send a signal to every member of this body that the Steve Bannon candidate can win. He can take you out. And that'll really shape how everybody's going to behave over the course of the next 12 months. And if that continues to shape how they behave, then there's not going to be any abandoning Donald Trump. There's not going to be any distancing from Donald Trump, no matter how frustrated he makes them. I mean, they'll give you off the record on background quotes about how angry he makes them. And unless they're in a really inoculated district where they're safe from those kind of voters, you're not going to hear that sort of thing from Republicans. So when do they shape up and be honest? You know, we got to go our own way, and we'll work with what we can. But this president isn't on our team, and we're not going to be waiting for him when it's too late.
Mm.
The point of diminishing returns is what I say. When Republicans are pretty much convinced that there's nothing more they can squeeze out of this guy, that he is an obstacle, he's a hazard more than a benefit. And at that point, they've already lost the majority in the House.
Right. It's like sort of passing an event horizon, coming towards a black hole. Past a certain point, the gravity won't let you escape. You know, you can try to skirt next to it, but you will not be able to escape the gravity of this black hole, you know. And I think that I'm actually more pessimistic than I think either you or Jay. I think we passed this event horizon. Probably somewhere last July or June, I think, maybe at the convention. It's really, you can kind of see, based on what we know of Trump and his character, his approach to issues, you could see how this was going to play out. I mean, the critics of Trump, the people who were dead set against him and making arguments against his character and arguments against his lack of ability to regulate his own emotions and work with other people, they've proved surprisingly prescient about how much this GOP Congress has gotten done and how much trouble he is causing for them. We've been doomed for a long time.
Yeah. I have a little bit of hope. Point where maybe we could actually get some significant reform. Early bumps in the road, but who knows? You know, there's plenty of opportunity for this guy to right the ship. But yeah. I've been, we've seen the president stumble over his own opportunities and make obstacles in his own path. Enough now to the future that this is going to be the behavior pattern moving forward. So, I generally think that that's a prudent point of view, albeit a pessimistic one.
Well, that's what the listeners of Fifth Estate want.
That's what they say about the commentary podcast too. We've adopted a moniker from one of our listeners as Crushing Morosity.
Well, I'm glad that we could get a small taste of that here on the Fifth Estate show tonight. No, I think we're going to start proceeding to wrap here, unless Jay has any other questions for you about the politics of the tax reform.
No, I'm okay. We're good.
Excellent, sir. Yeah. Well, so no, before
that
we
can be comprehensive. Appreciate
before we move on to our final question, is there anything coming up that you particularly want to plug? Any pieces of commentary or any upcoming projects of yours?
I'm writing a book.
Oh, really?
Yes, I am.
Oh, nice.
It's called Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America, coming up from Regnery. In a date to be determined in 2019, I'm busily writing it. There's no place for you to pre-order. And if there was, I would say you should do it. But keep an eye out for that in a year and a half.
Okay. Yeah, something to look forward to. So, Noah, thanks again for being with us. And as I said, we have one final question for you. This is a gotcha question. You know, we pride ourselves on civility and consideration towards our guests, but we do like to spring a gotcha question on everyone. And I warn you, it is a matter of vital cultural importance, sir. So your answer, it matters. The way you decide to answer this question means something. So I hope you understand the responsibility we're placing upon you. So, Noah Rothman, the question is, which is better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
The Rolling Stones.
Hell yeah.
Didn't even take half a second to even think about that.
Nicely
that's
done,
not even, that's not even
sir.
A question. That's an instinct.
Yes.
Who says the Beatles?
Jay.
Most people who know music better actually say the Beatles.
Oh, Jay.
To be fair, Noah, we are in a distinct minority here of Rolling Stones fans. I think this question has been going on for almost, I think, maybe 10, 11 episodes, and I think we've got maybe 3 in favor of the Rolling Stones.
That's absurd.
I don't think it's a question of, oh, I don't like the Rolling Stones, I like the Beatles. But it's like, you know, the question is revolves around, if you're going to bring somebody, if you have a chance to bring a catalog to a deserted island, what are you going to bring, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones? And it's unquestionably the Beatles.
It's very questionably the Beatles, because let's be honest here.
Unquestionably.
No, it's not necessarily about the catalog. That's just a device we use in case somebody's wishy-washy. What we need is just, which is better? Just go with your gut, your instinct.
The Beatles.
The instinct here is Rolling Stones, and it's a correct instinct. Noah, you've got the instincts of a tiger, my friend.
Well, I'm glad I got that one right. I think I disappointed everyone with the Seinfeld question.
Which one did you say on Seinfeld? Were you you said it was overrated.
No, I said it was underrated.
Oh
yes,
yeah.
No, he only disappointed Neil with that one.
Yeah, you made Jay very happy.
Well, that's also the right answer. So I'm 2 for 2 on this one.
Well, we appreciate it very much, and look forward to reading your pieces and commentary, and listening to the commentary podcast.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Rothman. Appreciate it. All right, Neil. Well, that's going to do it.
All right, Jay. Well, you can go chug some NyQuil and, you know, or some Robitussin. Go Robo Trip.
Yeah.
Hey. Some wellness.
Now, this is the question. We probably couldn't bring this question on here. I don't think you would even care either way. But for those of you who are Foo Fighters fans like I am, their new album comes out. I think it's couple days. It's the 15th.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, let's try to get one of the Foo Fighters on the show.
Well, you know, it's funny. Chris Shiflett is the one of the guitarists. He actually has his own podcast. And it's like if you're famous like that, you get to interview like all these famous people, and he just has like all these great musicians on there. It's like, I'd love to get one of the Foo Fighters on the show.
Well,
if I got Dave Grohl on the show, I would be like a teenage boy fan. You know, it'd be like such a geek. It would probably be embarrassing.
Don't worry, I would take care of it.
I'm just being honest, folks. I mean, that's just the way it is, you know. So,
well,
we could try
something to look for. Tell us in the comments, folks. Would you like to see one of the Foo Fighters?
Yeah.
On the show.
Would you like to see a Foo Fighter on the show? I mean, if you say yes, and if you sit there and say hell yeah, get a Foo Fighter on the show, then we'll move heaven and earth to try. If we can get Mike Rowe, I think we could probably land one of the Foo Fighters.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
All right. Until next time, I'm Jake Russo for Neil Dewing, and we'll see you next time on the Fifth Estate.